Welcome to Inspiration and Transformation from the Banks of the Ganga with Sadhvi Bhagwati Saraswati, an American sannyasi living at the Parmarth Nikatan Ashram in Rishikesh, India. Sadhvi is president of the Divine Shakti Foundation, a charitable organization bringing education, vocational training, upliftment, and empowerment programs to women and children. Sadhvi is also Secretary General of the Global Interfaith WASH Alliance and Director of the world-famous International Yoga Festival. Join the musings of an American sannyasi as Sadhvi shares the wisdom and teachings of her guru, His Holiness Pujya Swami Chidanand Saraswatiji.
Welcome, everyone, to Inspiration and Transformation from the Holy Banks of the sacred Ganga River in the land of Rishikesh, India. When do I know it is the right time to follow a higher calling and give up all in the pursuit of God and happiness? First of all, it's a very interesting irony, and actually a very, very tragic irony. Listen to the wording of the question. I won't read the whole thing again, but the gist is, when do I know that I should give it all up in the pursuit of God and happiness? So if what you have now isn't making you happy and doesn't have God, then what exactly do you have? What exactly are you giving up that is so difficult to give up? I mean, look at that tragic irony. When do I give it all up for God and happiness? Sometimes people ask, when do I give it up, you know, for austerities? Okay, so that's sort of a different way of thinking about it. But giving it up for God and happiness, well, now, whenever you have the thought, what is it that we're holding on to? If there isn't God or happiness in it. You know, it reminds me of one of my favorite stories about Hanuman, where at the end of the war, he's the hero. Those of you not familiar with the storyline of the Ramayana, don't worry about it for right now. We'll take it up at a different satsang. But for right now, all that matters is Hanuman is the hero. He's the epitome of devotion. The epitome of devotion to God. And Hanumanji worships God in the name and the form of Lord Ram. So after the war, where he was the hero, Lord Ram's wife, whom he rescued, gives him a pearl necklace as a gift. And she says to him, now Hanuman, be very careful because this is very, very precious. Take good care of this. Hanumanji is in the form of a monkey. So you have to have the picture in your mind when you hear the story. So Hanuman takes the necklace, and then Sita is watching as Hanuman takes the necklace, and he's looking at every single pearl, and he looks at it from this way and from that way and this way and that way, and then he bites them in half, again looks, spits them out, and he's going one by one through the pearls of this precious necklace, biting them, spitting them out. And finally, Sita Ma says, Hanuman, what are you doing? I told you that mala was very precious. And he says, well, yes, Sita Ma, if it's precious, it means that my Lord Ram is here. So I'm looking for Lord Ram in the pearls, and if he's not there, then it means that pearl is not precious, that pearl is worthless. So I spit it out and I go on to the next one. And I'm waiting till I find my Lord Ram in the pearl. That's when I'll know that's really the precious one. And I love that story because as indicated in the question, we sometimes lose sight of really what's precious. When you talk about giving it up for God and happiness, you've got to ask yourself again, what is it I'm giving up? Now, here's the interesting thing. Having a job does not keep you from being happy. Having a job does not keep you from being connected to God. There's all kinds of stories in the scriptures of even people with very low-level jobs, cobblers. This is why in the scriptures we have stories of rishis even, great sages, Santhray Das. He's a cobbler, okay? So there's no teaching in which, no truth in which having a job, even a low-level job, keeps you from being connected to God and happiness. A lot of us think, well, if I got a raise, if I got a promotion, if I got a better job, then I'd be happy. But the scriptures emphasize, doesn't matter what your job is, you have the opportunity to be happy. There's also nothing about having a family that should keep you from being connected to God or from being happy. Again, looking in the scriptures, lots of stories of householders, married men, married women, mothers, fathers, who are connected to God, who are happy. And so when we talk about giving it all up, it doesn't mean you must quit your job, you must abandon your family. What it means is you must give up that which is keeping you from being connected to God and keeping you from being happy. That's all you've got to give up. If you're talking about when is the right time to follow a higher calling and give it all up for God and happiness, it means give up that which is keeping you low and keeping you disconnected from God and happiness, which means some internal stuff, some external stuff. The internal stuff is what we talk about in here all the time. Our egos, our attachments, our jealousies, our competitions, our ignorance, our attachment to how the rest of the world is behaving. If you just act the way I want, speak the way I want, treat me the way I want, do what I want, then I'd be happy. That thought keeps me from being happy. That thought also, by the way, keeps me from God, because the underlying truth of that thought is, my happiness is dependent on you. Well, God has told us in so many different ways, in so many different scriptures, it is up to us. There's no scripture I know of, no divine teaching I know of in which God says, until and unless you can get your husband or your wife or your mother-in-law or your daughter-in-law to do what you want, thou shalt not be happy. Nowhere. In fact, we're taught the opposite. We're taught the mind is the answer. Man eva manushyanam karanam bandha mokshayo. The mind is the key. Am I going to be free or am I going to be in bondage? The mind is the key. And so that which is keeping me from happiness and from God is my own mind. So when am I going to give that up? The games of my mind? Well, no time like the present, as they say. Pooja Swamiji always says, whenever you wake up, it's morning. But there's also, along with that, there's some behaviors that if I'm really going to go on a higher calling, committed to God, committed to true joy, doesn't mean you have to leave everything and come to an ashram, but it does mean that there are some aspects of your life which will change. So for example, the way I spend my time, my free time, okay, I have to work, but the way I spend my free time, is it in ways that take me out of my truth or in ways that bring me closer to my truth? So I remember, for example, when I was back in America, back in Los Angeles with my parents, after having been in India maybe only a year at that time, maybe 2 years. And my mom says to me one day, she says, so Frank is my dad, really wants that tonight we should all go for dinner and a movie. So I say, okay. I was already not eating really from outside, but I thought, okay, no problem. I'll eat something before we go. I'll have some fruit. I'll have a salad. Make my parents happy, no problem. I said, let's do one thing. Let's take 2 cars to dinner so that after dinner I can come home and you people can go on to the movies. So she says, no, it's really important to your dad that you also come to the movies. Now, of course, I know that's not true because my dad wouldn't care. But what my mom has known since childhood is that the way to get me to do anything is to tell me that my dad wants it. Because I'm much more likely to do what he wants than what my mom wants. So she says, it's really important to him that you go to the movies. So I say, all right, no problem. I'll come to the movies with you. I will bring my laptop. I will sit in the lobby and work. You people, enjoy the movie. So my mom says, no, it's really important to him that you sit in the movie with us. I say to her, look, if you really want me, and it was some nice movie, I forget what they wanted to take me to, but it wasn't, you know, some violence and sex and whatnot. It was going to be some nice cultural movie. So I say, look, if you really want me to give you 2 hours of my life, I'm happy to give it to you. You've given me so much. You've given me so much of your life. I can give you 2 hours of mine. If it's really that important to you that I should sit next to you in the movie, I'll do that. I said, but here's what you need to understand. Here's why I don't want to go to the movies. I said, I would actually rather sit and stare at a blank wall for 2 hours than go to the movies. Because my meditation is not yet that strong that I can sit in a movie watching the movie and actually still be meditating. If I'm sitting next to you in the movie, all my attention is going to go into the movie. I'm going to get completely engrossed in the movie, and I will have essentially lost 2 hours of my life. Whereas if I'm staring at a blank wall, at least I can be meditating, I can pray, I can plan for projects. They didn't make me go to the movies. But I share the story with you because we've only got a few spare hours of our day. We have to eat, we have to sleep, we have to bathe, we have to work. Many of us have to go to work or there's not food on the table. And the question then becomes, what do I do with the remaining hours that I have? And in some cases, it's only a few. What do I do with that? What's my goal? And so if I've decided I'm going to give it all up for God and happiness, it means I need to take full control over those hours. How am I spending them? Am I spending them in movies? Not that movies are bad by any means. It's just The hours are gone. Am I spending them doing things that are giving me just temporary enjoyment? Or am I spending them in ways that are actually taking me closer to God, closer to true happiness? Am I spending them in service? God has told us, serve. See me in everyone. Serve the poor, serve the needy. Serve the gurus, serve the, I mean, this is what we're told, we're given. Am I doing that? And by the way, this isn't only Hinduism. Every religion of the world I know of has deep, deep emphases on service as an essential aspect of our spiritual life. So am I serving? So these aspects of your life will change when you decide to follow a higher calling of how you're actually spending your time. You'll find that your time feels much more precious to you, and you don't want to waste it. You know, it's interesting. Very frequently we'll say, well, I don't have time. The truth is, we all have time to do whatever we want. It's just, what do I make time for? And so, for example, somebody may say to me, if I'm back in California, oh, let's go to the movies. Well, chances are I'm going to say, I would love to. Unfortunately, I don't have the time. Now, that's true, meaning not that I'm so busy I cannot pull away 2 hours, but it means that all of my waking hours in my hands that I'm not sleeping, eating, bathing are precious. I don't have enough time even in them to do all the spiritual work that I want to do all the seva I want to do. And so there isn't time for something that's much lower on my list. I may say to someone, you know, I don't have time to go to the movies, but why don't you come with me? Let's meditate together. Let's have satsang. Now he or she may say, oh, I'd love to, I don't have time. Again, true. Because the way that he or she is choosing to spend their time is going to be different. There isn't time at the end of their day to do those things. Each of us has to make decisions. What are my priorities? And so when I decide I'm going to give it up for a higher calling, for God, for happiness, it means I'm going to give up unconsciously wasting my time. Doesn't mean I won't have fun. Doesn't mean I won't enjoy life. Doesn't mean I'll never see a movie. Doesn't mean I'll never play a game. But it means I'll do it all consciously. I'm going to choose how I spend my time consciously. And I'm going to ensure that whatever I'm doing is really in service of God and of that higher calling. And that's what's going to bring me happiness. And so why not choose that now? The time for that is the minute that thought comes to you. So whoever's question this is, the answer is now. But it doesn't mean you have to give up your job and your family. Just give up that which is keeping you from God, keeping you from the deeper happiness. Slowly, 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 as life circumstances change, you may give up other pieces. But there's no rule that you have to.
You're listening to OTRFM, part of the IOM Radio Network.
Being a radio host on IOM FM allows you to build your show on a rich platform with the power of the internet to fulfill your outreach goals and connect with a very specialized and global online audience, unlimited by time and distance. OM Times Radio will provide you with web relevance, a recognizable conscious brand, and with the standard of excellence that has accompanied every single
Circle of Hearts Radio is a sanctuary on the airwaves. Join me, Grandmother Alaya, in the circle on Sunday, 2 p.m. Eastern, as I share information to both enlighten and nourish your soul.
Hi, this is Christina Ricci with RAIN. Every 2 minutes, another American is sexually assaulted. If you or someone you know has been sexually assaulted, you are not alone. Help is just a call or click away through the National Sexual Assault Hotline. Please call 1-800-656-HOPE, that's H-O-P-E, or visit rain.org, that's RAINN.ORG.
Brought to you by RAIN and this station.
Welcome back to Inspiration and Transformation. I'm so glad to have you all back here with me.
What's the life of a renunciant in this age? From the basic lifestyle, such as eating and sleeping habits, to the most rigorous of sadhanas, who is appropriate to live that life? So, the lifestyle of a renunciant, or sannyasi in this age, is very much like it always was. Yes, there's more now that attracts us outside. So there's more specific things to renounce, you could say. But that doesn't actually, I don't have memories of past lives living at times where, you know, we didn't have all of this. But my instinct is, I don't actually think that it makes that much of a difference. The difficulty in renunciation is not over the individual thing. It's not, oh my God, pizza. Just can't, won't be able to live without pizza. I mean, I don't think it's that. I've never heard of anybody really drawn to take a path of renunciation and say, but you know, that pizza thing, there's no way, or you know, that shopping mall thing, that's the thing keeping me from it. I don't think so. I've never heard that. That certainly was not my experience. That which we renounce is a renunciation of that which keeps us stuck. And that's ultimately what it's about. It's not about a renunciation just of this food or that type of shopping. It's a renunciation of that which keeps us stuck from being able to live fully immersed in God. And so, for example, we take vows of celibacy, but I think renouncing sex today is probably very similar to renouncing sex 100 years ago or 200 years ago. I mean, there may be more options available to people today than there were 500 years ago. But I don't think that the renunciation of it is different whether you have 500 different options to choose from or whether you have one option to choose from. The renunciation is a renunciation of ownership and attachment. And again, I don't think it really matters. I've never heard of someone say, well, I've only got this many things, and so, okay, I can renounce. But if I've got this many things, well, then I couldn't renounce. Whatever we have, we're very attached to them. You see it even with people who have very little. It doesn't matter what they have. They're very attached. Whether it's a possession, whether it's power. One of the things I always laugh at around here coming in from the West is the way that people hold so tenaciously to whatever power they have, whatever desk they might be the head of, if that's all they've seen. this particular desk or this particular, you know, 200 meter stretch of world. Well, then to be the one in charge of that 200 meter stretch of the world, that's everything. For people who haven't actually seen the world. When you've actually seen the world, you realize, oh, wait, I'm king of kind of nowhere. But when you haven't seen it, there's that incredible tenacity with which people hold on. So I don't think that letting go of attachment changes today because there's so much compared to 50 or 100 or 500 years ago. Can't imagine someone saying, well, all I've got is, you know, a cave and some tools and, you know, a wife or a husband and a couple of kids and this little plot of land. Therefore, no problem, I'll renounce. Or I've only got 10 sheep, okay, I'll renounce. Whereas today we say, okay, so I've got this big house, I can't renounce. I don't think so. I think that it's much more of an internal experience of attachment than actually a matter of what we have. And so in that way, I don't think that renunciation today actually looks that much different on the inside than it probably did 50 or 100 or 500 years ago or 5,000 years ago. You know, we get all of these stories from the scriptures of renunciants getting tempted. We actually just, was it yesterday or the day before that we celebrated Netaji's Jayanti?
A few days ago.
So just a couple days ago, we celebrated the Jayanti of the great sage, Netaji. And there's a beautiful story of his life. He was a great sage, great renunciant. One day, this king says to him, I need you to read my daughter's palm. I need you to tell us. The kings, the monarchs, always really used to turn to the spiritual people, the sages, the saints, for wisdom and guidance. And so it was not unusual at all for a king to call upon a sage for even guidance about his house and his daughter. So he calls Netaji and says, please, could you look at my daughter's palm? Netaji takes the princess's palm and looks at it and falls in love. And he holds it and, oh, the palm, this hand, it's so soft, it's so beautiful. And then he looks up at the face that the palm belongs to and, oh, Netaji is so. Not long after that was going to be the time in which she was choosing her husband. This is how the princesses used to choose their husbands, was they would call all of the eligible men from their kingdom, from the neighboring kingdoms, would come together, and the princess would choose who she wanted to be her prince. So Netaji decides, I've got to be the one to win this princess's hand. So he goes to Lord Vishnu, and he says, "Ki apko kuch karna hai, you've got to do something. Give me the face of Hari. Give me this face of God, so that I can win her hand." So Lord Vishnu says, "Done." And Netaji's very happy. So he shows up that day and takes his place in line, and the princess, the way they did it was the princess would have a flower garland. And she would walk, and she would walk through the rows, and she would behold all of the men. Whomever she chose, she would garland him. So Netaji's standing there in line, completely convinced that of course it must be him, because he's got this incredibly divine face. So she walks by him, and she kind of snickers a little bit. And then she keeps going. And Naraji is baffled. What's happened? And so he goes and stands in the other line also, because she must have maybe not seen. And whenever she passes him, she just kind of gently giggles, snickers, and keeps going. Now, it was the days before people walked around with pocket mirrors, of course. So Naraji didn't know exactly what he looked like, but he knew that Lord Vishnu had given him this divine face. So finally, after she chooses someone else, Naraji he's very confused. And he goes out and he looks at his reflection in a lake. And actually, Vishnuji has given him the face of a monkey. Now you can imagine how irate he must be, right? So he runs after Lord Vishnu. He's furious. How could you do this? And Vishnuji explains to him, look, this is not what your life was supposed to be for. You are the one who's going to give us the Bhakti Sutras. You are the one who is this great sage. Your life is not meant to be wrapped up just with this beautiful princess. And I share that story because we're going back thousands and thousands and thousands of years. Naraji was a wandering sage. He didn't have much to renounce, but nonetheless, he needed God to step in. I'll tell you a personal story. There was a time in my life, post coming to India, post being here, post living all of this incredibly divine life, in which I found myself very similar probably to Naraji in that case, just very kind of enamored of, intoxicated by, you could say. In America, we would say, I had a crush on a gentleman. And I went to Puja Swamiji, right? I mean, this was sort of a spiritual type of crisis. And I went to him. But I went, A, with this, here's what's going on, but B, with the giggles of a 20-something-year-old woman intoxicated by a handsome man. And I couldn't even actually get the words out to Puja Swamiji, but he understood. I told him who it was about, and he doesn't look much. He's just writing something. Finally, there's this silence. And he looks up at me, and I must have been all kinds of shades of pink and purple and red and whatnot. And he looks at me, and he says, oh, God. And this was when he tells me this story of Naraji. Okay, that was how I learned this story. And at the end of the story, he says, someday, you understand. And I looked at him and he says, either you figure this thing out or I'm going to have to give you a monkey face. So here we have thousands of year gap, completely different situations, but the same situation. And the same solution to the same situation. Same answer to the same situation. So, renunciation in this age, renunciation in any age, is about a decision that my life is for God. Doesn't mean that you don't notice the things of the world, but it means that you realize this is not for me. My life is meant for something else. And so, in the last part of the question, who is it for? You know, who is eligible? Well, anyone for whom they know deep inside that the things of the world, whether as superficial as actual possessions and sensory pleasures or as deep as the relationships that we have in a family. That's not the path for me. Not that it's not the path for others, not that there's anything wrong with that path, but simply the awareness that's not my path. My path is a single-pointed focus to God. Single-pointed attention, single-pointed focus. What I want more than I want to own anything, more than any relationship that I want, more than any pleasure that I want. Is to be connected to God. Is to have that enlightenment, awakening, connection with me all the time. And to be able to use 100% of my time and energy for God. In service to God, in service to humanity. That's what I want more than I want anything else. Not that I can't see that this looks pretty or that tastes good or that feels good or, oh, that would be nice. Not that we somehow lose our senses or lose our sight, but that we realize this isn't the path that I want. This isn't the path for me. This isn't my dharma. And so everyone is eligible for it. It just requires a level of awareness and commitment. But now here's what's important also. And this is true whether we're looking at a life of actual full renunciation or just a life of spirituality. A lot of us think, first, I will become pure. First, I will deal with all of this other baggage that I have. I'll deal with my desires. I'll deal with my anger. I'll become free of all that. And then I will be worthy of walking a spiritual path. Then I will be worthy of renouncing. And that actually isn't true. Spirituality is, it's the doorway. It's the pathway through the doorway. It's the garden you reach as you walk the path through the doorway. It's the soil, the seeds, the flowers, the fruit, the experience of being in the garden that you've walked through the doorway on the path. It's not something that you have to have it all figured out first and then you're eligible to be spiritual. Pooja Swamiji always says, God never opens your old files. And it's an incredible teaching for those of us who walked onto a spiritual path feeling anything other than the purest, the most perfect, the best ones, the deserving ones, the righteous ones. Because there's this sense of guilt of, oh wait, I've still got anger. I've still got desires. I've still got fears. I've still got complexes. I'm not quite done with the stuff that happened to me in the first 10 years of my life. You know, that's still kind of impacting me in different ways. And a lot of us think, well, first I've got to deal with all of that. Then I can go to God. Then I will be worthy of going to God. And this awareness that, wait, God knows all that. God's not saying to you, figure yourself out first and then come to me. God doesn't have any prerequisites. Grace doesn't have any prerequisites. There's no checklist you need to tick off before you're eligible for grace. Anger, done. Desires, done. Greed, done. Confusion, done. History, done. There's no checklist. There's no prerequisites. The only thing required to walk a spiritual life, the only thing required for God, for grace, is the heart that says, this is what I want. And that is true whether you are inclined toward a full path of renunciation or just inclined to being on a spiritual path in whatever lifestyle you're living. Either way, start with your spiritual practice right now. Know that God accepts you right now. Now, obviously, for renunciation, you want to at least be sure. You want to at least be clear enough that it's not sort of the whim of the moment. It's also not an escape. It's not, oh, well, I'm fed up with my life, therefore I will renounce. It's a walking toward, not a walking away from. But there's no prerequisite of who you have to be good enough for God, other than fully surrendered and fully ready to take that step, fully ready to be one with God. And again, this is true regardless of whether it's full renunciation or just, I really need to become spiritual. Going to keep my job, going to keep the family, going to keep the house where I live, but I really need to be spiritual. Either way, and anywhere in between, you are already good enough. And grace will take care of the rest. That's what I've learned. It's not about finish it up first and then you're good enough for grace. It's surrender to grace. And then grace actually, gracefully, takes care of it. But when you talk about renunciation, it's not just a letter of the law, it's a spirit of the law. And so when we speak about renouncing, for example, it's not just a renunciation of attachment that, okay, I will actually give away my things, but then I'm going to sit here and think about them. Okay, I will become celibate, but then I'm going to sit here and just have sex in my mind. That's not renunciation. The path of renunciation is a path of it from your life and from your mind. Now again, that doesn't mean that we're not human. It doesn't mean that we're perfect. I've shared the example of when thoughts came to me. Thoughts come. But rather than take that thought and say, oh, that sounds like fun. I guess it's not really breaking my vow if I just do it in my mind. Okay, cello, let's have fun. Instead of that, it's an awareness of wait. That thought is actually detracting me from the path that I'm on. Doesn't make me bad, doesn't make me wrong, doesn't make me dirty. But it means that I need to be aware of that and therefore deal with that thought in such a way that it stops detracting me. And so there's lots of practices. I won't go into them now, but there's practices of training the mind. Because I'll tell you something, if your mind is not trained, do not think it is easy to train your body. Do not think, oh, I'll just sit here and experience it all in my mind, but I won't do it with my body. Not so easy. Where the mind goes, eventually the body goes. This is why we are taught, watch your thoughts. So it's, yes, of course, you could sit here and experience everything, but that isn't the point. The point, interestingly, is the opposite. How to be amidst it all and actually still renounced from it. So it's not, I won't own anything, but I'll sit here and think about them. It's, I could be walking through a shopping center. I could be walking down Fifth Avenue in New York and be unattached. So it's not, I'm going to sit here, not look at any women, but have sex in my mind. It's even being amidst women. I see them as soul. I see them as spirit. And if I can't do that, I see them as my sister or my mother. But ultimately, ideally, I see them as spirit. I see them as consciousness. I see them as God. So the real renunciation is not just I'm now going to experience everything inside. It's I can be in the world, but my mind isn't stuck. My mind is not window shopping on any level. That's the real renunciation.
This is OTRFM, part of the IOM radio network.
OM Times Magazine is one of the leading online content providers of positivity, wellness, and personal empowerment. A philanthropic organization, their net proceeds are funneled to support worldwide charity initiatives via Humanity Healing International. Through their commitment to creating community and providing conscious content, they aspire to uplift humanity on a global scale. OM Times, co-creating a more conscious lifestyle.
Do you have time to read that inspiring book or that blog post you've been meaning to get to? In your busy world, how do you improve yourself and keep your life going? I'm Lisa Kay, and my Between Heaven and Earth radio show can transform your life just by listening. Be uplifted with inspiring topics, positive stories, and ideas that really work. Between Heaven and Earth radio is conscious living for your soul every Wednesday at 4 p.m. Eastern Time.
Baldwin with People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals. I grew up loving circuses and other traveling animal shows, but it never occurred to me what life might be like for the animals. Training wild animals to do things they don't understand takes force. Routine discipline with a hook or whip with the heel of a boot shows the animal exactly who's the boss. Don't patronize animal acts. Please contact People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals.
757-622-PETA.
Welcome back. This is Sadhvi Bhagavati Saraswati with Inspiration and Transformation.
Is God both good and evil? God is everything. But evil arises. Evil arises out of ignorance. In the Hindu tradition, we don't speak about evil as evil, because what we believe is that the core of who we are is pure and perfect and divine. We've been created not just by the divine, but of the divine, which means that who you are is divine, is pure, is perfect, is not just good, but is capital G good. It's beautiful, perfect. But then we have ignorance. And the ignorance is that which says, I am this body. And when we say body, we don't just mean neck down. We also mean that which exists inside our skull. And that's the brain. And the brain is the medium through which we experience our mind, our thoughts, our emotions, our identities. And when we identify with all of that, we start to identify with what we want, who we think we are, whether by my color, by my race, by my religion, by my socioeconomic status, by my power. We identify by things that have happened to us that we are impacted by. So if I was abused, for example, I'm much more likely to abuse someone. Not because I'm an evil human being, but because the abuse created a sanskar in me, a pattern in me, a belief system in me that leads me to abuse others or abuse myself through addictions, alcoholism, whatever it may be, self-destructive tendencies. Now, none of that is evil. It's I've identified with something that's happened. It happened to my body. But I've identified it as myself, and I act on it. When I identify as a wronged party, I identify as a victim, for example, well, I'm then going to act to get back what I think you've stolen from me. So if I feel like a victim, you've stolen from me, you've lied to me, you've cheated me. Maybe I'm going to do something really horrible and kill you. Maybe something not quite as horrible and just hit you in the face. Nonetheless, they're on the spectrum of what you could call evil. Certainly killing you is evil. Hitting you might be considered evil. But again, none of it comes because I'm an evil person. It comes because I have falsely identified as an injured victim. I've identified as the one from whom you stole. I've identified as separate from you. And I've therefore acted out of that ignorance. If you look at all of that which we consider evil in the world, it all arises out of ignorance. And ignorance is an umbrella. Under the umbrella of ignorance, we get ego, we get greed, we get lust, we get delusion, we get all of that that leads us to do things that could be termed evil. But we are not evil. We are ignorant. So when we speak about God, God is not evil. We are not evil. Even people who do evil things are not evil. They are ignorant. Now, it doesn't mean that we're minimizing the horribleness of what they've done. It doesn't mean that we're minimizing the punishment that they should receive, karmic punishment as well as legal punishment. But it means that there isn't a gene that's evil. There's genes that impact our brains in different ways that make it less easy for us to connect and empathize with others, easier for me to harm others, but that's not evil. That's deficient. That's defective. Not evil. Even if you look in the scriptures at the quote-unquote evil demons. So you take, for example, the story of the Ramayana, the great epic of the Ramayana. Well, so who's the demon of the Ramayana? Ravan, right? The demon king, the evil one. Well, interestingly, he actually wasn't. He was actually a brilliant Vedic scholar. Who became a little too ignorantly attached to the form, to the power of the form, to the lust, to the greed, to the power, to the separation. To the victimness of how dare you harm my sister. To the whole story that led to the evil acts stemmed not from evil inside, but from ignorance. And so this is where it's so important for us to ensure the cultivation of jnana, the cultivation of true knowledge. That's where we emphasize the path of wisdom. Yes, being kept from evil is a separate benefit. But the path of wisdom is the path that takes us to know the truth of who we are, to experience the divine. So no, God isn't evil. But evil brews. Evil acts brew in ignorance. And that's why wisdom is so important. Gyan is so important. Light is so important. So if you ever find yourself either on the verge of doing something that you know is evil or feels evil, or with someone who you think is going to do something that seems evil, rather than telling them what horrible people they are, or telling yourself what a horrible person you are, see what you can do to bring about wisdom. See what you can do to lessen the death grip on ignorance that they're holding. And whether wisdom can begin to blossom and brew there.
This brings to a close this hour of inspiration and transformation. Thank you so much for joining me. I'm so glad to be together with you all each week. And I look forward to being together again next Thursday, same time, on Om Times Radio.